Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is March 21st, 2013. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Upcoming events, I'm going to be leaving Tennessee on the middle of April and headed to Boulder for a video shoot, and then meetings in Nebraska and a weekend with John Rubino of Dollar Collapse in Moscow, Idaho, and then on my way to Portland where I'll be speaking as part of the Illihi Lecture Series on April 24th in Portland. And then we're going to have a luncheon for subscribers April 27th in Portland. So if you're in the area, just sign up at the blog. Tonight, Coming Clean, starting a Solari Circle Investment Club with Paul Ferguson. And our theme tonight, very appropriately, is Let's Do a Deal. When, as of 1996, I had designed and led as an investment banker approximately $25 billion of transactions. I'm a deal doer. I love doing deals. One of my favorite moments during that $25 billion of deal doing is a story of a gentleman named Albert Sullivan. He's our quote for the week. He was a remarkable career civil servant at the Federal Housing Administration, and he ran all of the multifamily apartment building workouts on defaulted and sort of troubled properties. He was from Chicago, a very brave soul, very creative. And my company had designed a $10 billion loan sale program for the Federal Housing Administration. And that program made a very significant shift in the markets by introducing online disclosure innovations and applying optimization software technology to mortgage auctions. And it very much shifted the market because it bid the real estate and mortgage and securities markets against each other, something they don't like. And one of the famous quotes was the head of the Harvard Endowment Real Estate Portfolio using the F word and almost hanging up on me because he was so angry. He said he couldn't win the bids except by bidding higher. So it pitted the markets against each other, and it really did shift the markets. But everybody was afraid to sort of launch with our first deal, and we were sitting in a room, everyone frozen. And Al smiled and said, let's do a deal. And suddenly everybody and everything unfroze, and you had this feeling in the room, yeah, we can do this. And the rest is history. It turned into the most successful auction program in the history of the U.S. government. And it was certainly one that reversed the power equation in the interests of communities and taxpayers for the brief period of time when it was allowed to happen. I mention this because the pathway to the future is through deals and deal making. Whether it's we make deals with our time or we make deals with our money, the better we are at coming together and finding out what gives each other energy and then making deals to make things happen, to build everything from time and money savers in a neighborhood to creating and building great companies. The future is built through transactions. Last week I talked about how life goes on no matter how ugly the legacy systems are right now, and this week we have a perfect example of the new economy and deal-making infographics that will go up on the blog tomorrow. On Kickstarter reports that in 2012 they distributed $274 million to artists. That was from donations from 2,241,475 people. So 2.2 million people contributed $274 million to artists. To give you a sense of comparison, that is $120 million more than was given out by the National Endowment of the Arts, who gave out $146 million. And that's only in 3 years. In 2010, the National Endowment of the Arts gave out $160-plus million. Kickstarter only $23 million in their first year of operation. In 3 years, Kickstarter has completely overtaken and eclipsed the National Endowment of the Arts. So it just goes to show you. It reminds me very much of my time. I was a board member at one point of the New York City Food Bank. Our surveys done by the Hunger and the Homeless Coalitions showed that the American people were very quite generous, that if they believed a solution would work, that they would provide significant funding to stop hunger and homeless. However, in no sense of the word would they give a dime to government, because they didn't believe if they gave the money to government to stop hunger and homelessness that it would work or help. So they did not believe it would be spent well and achieve the result. But the Kickstarter proves that millions of Americans are ready to make philanthropic deals to support games, videos, movies, music, publishing, theater, photography, dance, and more. So, yep, it's time. Let's move forward and make deals. So that's why tonight I wanted to talk about starting a Solaria Circle Investment Club with Paul. A Solaria Circle is a financial action club. It's one of many things you can do as investment. So we're only going to talk about one aspect of how you might use a circle. But tonight Paul and I are going to be discussing one possible vehicle for you to start doing deals. Money and markets. The story of the week is Cyprus. We saw last weekend the European Union bailout be put to Cyprus, and Cyprus has now rejected it, and let's talk about what's really going on. Cyprus is a small island south of Turkey, east of Syria. It's right smack in the middle of a motherlode of natural gas deposits, which has great strategic importance for Europe, and because they do, great strategic importance to Russia. Russia is the greatest supplier of gas and oil into the European markets. So Russia has a great interest in the natural gas deposits in the Mediterranean, and naturally the United States does, since our worldwide global reserve currency is in essence backed by an oil standard. And so Cyprus is sitting smack in the middle of enormous geopolitics between the United States and Russia and the strategic needs of the European markets. Now, Cyprus has a history, and the Cyprus people have a history of being quite feisty. The Templars at one point bought Cyprus from King Richard, and had so much difficulty governing the Cyprus population that they sold it back after much bloodshed. So Cyprus has got that kind of history. Now we see Cyprus has become an offshore money haven, and a very significant amount of offshore deposits. Various reports in the last 2 weeks have been anywhere from 30 to 70 billion euro, with more than half, if not a significant majority, being Russian offshore money. And so Cyprus has suffered their economy, and believe it or not, one of the great instigators was Russia was sending explosions to Syria several years ago, and the U.S. Navy confiscated them, stockpiled them on Cyprus, and lo and behold, there was a huge explosion, caused tremendous damage to the power supply in Cyprus, approximately $3 billion of damage, and that was followed up by the Greek bailouts, with the Cyprus economy being very much tied into the Greek and the banking system in Greece. And so that economy has been hit hard, and sure enough, one of the things that Cyprus had done, of course, had become part of the EU. And the problem is when your economy gets hit hard, but you are on the EU currency, then you don't have the kind of monetary tools at your disposal that someone like a Ben Bernanke does. And so you can't just print currency the way that the central banks, certainly the Federal Reserve, can here. So we see a bailout proposal that came before the vote this weekend, and you have the IMF and the EU proposing to put a tax on bank deposits. Now, with a significant amount of Russian offshore money, at one point it was a two-tier proposal that would hit the offshore money much harder, but literally a 9% tax, you have a real targeting of the Russian interests in Cyprus. So this is more than just a straight financial bailout. This is very much geopolitics, particularly around natural gas and the Russians' position in Cyprus. But let's look at that 9%, because all week long I've been getting emails from subscribers and readers of the blog saying, well, wait a minute, are we the next to have our deposits taxed or confiscated? What's going on in the Cyprus bailout, to me, in one sense, has nothing to do with federal deposit insurance, and let's see why. Currently, it is possible to argue that our deposits are being confiscated at a tax of 9% a year. Shadow Stats, as I said last week, is now estimating that U.S. inflation is running at 9.6%. That's essentially a debasement of our deposits at the same, because let's say you're getting anywhere from 0 to 0.5% on your deposits. Essentially, that means your deposits are being taxed at a 9% rate now. But of course, the United States, because it can debase the currency, can do that in a way that the Cyprus economy can. And that's what I said about the difficulty of trying to run a nation when you don't control the currency. But whether you're taxed on the 9% direct tax or debased at a 9% inflation rate, the results one way or another is the same. The problem in the European Union, if you're going to debase the Cyprus population with a euro, you're going to have to debase the Germans. And, of course, this is what has been the whole issue between the North and the South. The Northern voters don't want to be debased, and so what is the EU to do? Well, this is the argument as to why, of course, you want to control your currency. Now the problem, the message, and this is why it was very surprising that that the IMF and the EU would do this. The message is, if your offshore deposits in any of the countries that have financial difficulties, Portugal, Spain, and Italy, then in fact the EU and the IMF reserves the right to tax you at a 9% rate. So if you want to make sure to avoid getting in that tricks box, everybody should pull their money back home. Well, imagine globally if everybody pulled their money back to their home base. You would see enormous wrenching dislocations in the global economy, which is why all week long we heard talks about contagion. Now, one of the big questions is why in the world would Christine Lagarde at the IMF agree to all of this? Well, interestingly enough, 2 weeks ago we saw reports in the press that the rumors of investigation for criminal allegations relating to events long ago was once again on the table. After the bailout was refused, we see the French enforcement move in and do a search of Lagarde's apartment in France. Very unusual. At this point, when you see this kind of global geopolitics competition targeting officials with criminal investigations, that's when you know the war is getting really, really mean. I've said it before, but people are going at each other. One of the officials in the Bush administration with me said, it's like we're in a rubber lifeboat and everybody's going at each other with razor blades. So what next? We see talk throughout the sort of both the financial blogosphere and the mainstream press, will Cyprus do in Iceland? In other words, will they pull out of the euro and issue their own currency and pull themselves up with their bootstraps? Certainly that tactic has been much more successful for Iceland than staying in the euro and going along with austerity has been for Portugal, Spain, or Greece. And certainly if you look at the anger and the strength behind the Cyprus population, they really have the wherewithal and the resources to do it. So it's going to be interesting to watch over the next week what happens. This is a very important story, both in terms of control of strategic resources that feed Europe and on the future of the euro. It raises another very important question, and that is a question that we talked about last week, and you're starting to see that theme repeat itself in many different discussions around the economy, and that is, what is the role of government guarantees, and can government guarantees ultimately do any good in its economy if they make all the different players within the economy indifferent to the health of the economy? Because ultimately, with no health in the economy, how good can government guarantees be? So I don't think that the abrogation of the euro deposit insurance in Cyprus has direct implications for FDIC, but I think the deeper story has great implications for all of us, no matter where we are on planet Earth, and that is, if we don't individually and collectively take responsibility for the whole, and therefore the whole is never healthy, then the notion that we can escape from the ramifications of an unhealthy, whether it's an environment or economy, is absurd. Of course, we're all going to, in the end, suffer. And the notion that we can guarantee ourselves out of taking responsibility or bearing the ramifications of the absence of taking responsibility is, of course, absurd. So let me give you an example. Once upon a time, when banks would finance mortgages in a neighborhood, they would hold those mortgages on their balance sheet. And then the bankers in that area had a tremendous vested interest in the neighborhood being run well and not crime not being permitted, narcotics trafficking not being permitted. It's very important that the schools be good if the real estate values were going to stay up. So banks had a tremendous financial interest in making sure that the health and the vitality of the people in the community were sound, because that's how their profits were determined. If people were successful, if the real estate in the neighborhood had value, they made money. We switched to a system of government guarantees, so government guaranteed not just the deposits, but essentially guaranteed the mortgages. You bundled them up and sold them into FHA or VA or Fannie or Freddie, and the banks could keep making money even if the neighborhood went to pot. And so we stopped aligning the interests of the bank and the local financial system with the health of the people and the small businesses and the real estate in that neighborhood. Government guarantees built a non-alignment, and people stopped caring about the health of the whole because they could make money. In fact, they could make money on the neighborhood failing. So it's very, very important that we start to think about, okay, how can we individually and collectively take responsibility for the whole? Because the only way, ultimately, that we're all going to be in an economically good position is if the whole is healthy and growing. Another comment that I wanted to draw from Cyprus, interestingly enough, this quote comes from one of Stratford's comments on it. He said, the global financial crisis of 2008 has slowly yielded to a global unemployment crisis. The unemployment crisis will fairly quickly give way to a political crisis. The crisis involves all three of the major pillars of the global system, Europe, China, and the United States. The level of intensity differs, the political response differs, and the relationship to the financial crisis differs. But there is a common element, which is that unemployment is increasingly replacing finance as the central problem of the financial system. So what is Stratford saying? Another way that I would say this is that uneconomic centralization rigged through government credit and force and government guarantees is part of creating very expensive externalities and lawlessness, which is, of course, bringing about lots of unemployment, which does ultimately collapse the economy. The reality is, and one of the reasons the Iceland solution works, is we need law, we need markets, and we need a way to shift the economy in the face of disruptive technology, which is part of what's creating unemployment as well. So one of the neat reasons I wanted to talk tonight about the joy of deal doing is it's exactly in the face of this kind of unemployment and this kind of wealth destruction that it is that much more important that we build enterprises and activities that create income, that lower expenses, that create sustenance for people who are losing their jobs and forms of income in the old economy. Now, I say that's absolutely critical. At the same time, whatever happens on Cyprus, I believe it's unlikely to change the likelihood of a slow burn. As I said at the beginning of the year, I think very high chances that we're going to slow burn for 2013. There's tremendous fear-mongering on the Internet. Please just avoid it and turn it off. We need to keep things in perspective. There is one good piece of news. Partisanship, the latest read from Washington, will kill tax reform for now. Let me read you a few things from last week's Friday Kiplinger newsletter. More talk in Washington about tax reform, but don't hold your breath. The two parties' ideas about what reform means diverge wildly. Republicans want this, Democrats want this, and the window of opportunity is narrow. If neither side blinks by August, jockeying for position before the 2014 elections will close the opening till 2015. Even then, long odds of reform as the gulf between the parties will remain wide. Our hero tonight is Ben Lazzardi of Lazzardi Communications. Ben, Lazzardi Communications does all of our wonderful graphic designs. If you look at our Coming Clean poster or the posters that we do for the wrap-ups every year or the wonderful transcripts that Ben has made for the equity overview or the annual wrap-up we did this year, it's all coming from Lazzardi Communications. Ben is one of the most amazing entrepreneurs I've ever worked with. If you've ever read the book Energy Leadership, he epitomizes the entrepreneur who, no matter what challenge comes his way, looks at everything in a higher mind and considers everything an opportunity. He sold his very successful marketing communications company And then one by one, his clients came back to him and said, could you do this for me? Could you do that? He's one of the busiest entrepreneurs I know. He has an endless flow of clients. He's never looking for work. Everything pours in by word of mouth. And he works very, very hard, and he never complains. And he is an absolute consummate deal doer. He's got he's got three generations now of Lizardi who are all engaged in entrepreneurial efforts, creating and starting businesses and doing amazing things. And he's a perfect example of the kind of person who, if we started to organize our economy to support and let people like Ben Lizardi loose, I assure you, give us 3 to 5 years, everybody would be back to work. One question and ask Catherine, or one comment that I wanted to comment on. We have a wonderful subscriber from Arizona writes, as a subscriber to your blog, I must say that I view the world through an entirely different lens than ever before. It is a blessing, but also something of a curse in that my old associations and conversations concerning politics, finance, health, and environment have altered so much that I find myself at a distance whenever someone else is totally influenced through corporate media, party affiliation, societal and environmental organizations. Many thanks. So what I wrote back is what I absolutely believe. With your old associations, just try loving them and quietly looking for opportunities for your knowledge to help them in a manner that is energizing for both of you. Your knowledge makes you powerful. Use that power to serve, respecting each person's right to choose their individual purpose and path. Once upon a time, I used to struggle with this when I woke up one day and realized my map of what was going on was very, very different than other people's. At the same time, what I realized is not everybody wants to really know what's going on. They find it, for a variety of reasons, unappealing to do so. And what I found is that it's remarkably easy for me to use my knowledge to support and help them in the way that they would find interesting or helpful. And I don't really need to share my map with them, and they don't need to share their map with me. So it's very possible to love and enjoy somebody else's company, but not necessarily share a commitment to understanding what's really going on. So with that, let me turn to the interview, which I'm very much looking forward to. We're going to talk about one particular aspect of what a Solari Circle can do. And before I introduce our wonderful guest, Paul Ferguson, I want to talk a little bit about Solari Circles. I came to the notion of organizing to come together to do circles because I realized as the environment got more and more complicated and the economic situation got more and more troublesome, I realized there was a tremendous need and opportunity for people to start to learn about how the financial ecosystems worked around them and to collaborate and take action together in a way that would help each other, protect each other, make you sort of raise our immune system from being drained by the debasement, and then really help us take advantage of all sorts of opportunities around us to build wealth despite, you know, sort of the different things that are going on. I grew up in a world where everything was run through conspiracies. I never thought of a conspiracy as anything that was particularly wrong. That was kind of how the world got together. You saw an opportunity, you got together, you quietly, you know, discussed how you were going to take advantage of it, and then you proceeded to take action. And so my personal experience was that the world was run through millions and millions of successful and profitable conspiracies, small and large. To me, that was how everything got done. What I didn't realize is how many of us don't feel it empowered to just start creating and executing conspiracies. So to me, I think of a Solari Circle as a kind of conspiracy. I'm always saying at the end of the report, don't worry about if there is one. If you're not in one, you need to start one. And so when you consider, do I want to start a Solari Circle? And if so, how would it benefit me? And what kind of circle do I want to do? I want you to think instead, you know, what kind of conspiracy would most help me deal with my life the way it's going or help me get to where I want to go? What kind of conspiracy would I most enjoy? And who would I most enjoy having as a co-conspirator? So don't think of it as a Solari Circle. Think of it as a conspiracy. So what is a Soleri Circle? It's an intimate group. I feel it should be 12 or fewer people. I think you need to keep this to a group of people who is very small and very intimate, who you can trust, and who are really committed to helping enhance each other's real wealth. Again, it's critical that it be fun, and it's critical that you organize in it in a way that you give each other energy. The first thing a Soleri can do, and it's always, even if you get together for investment, I think it always makes sense to start with some of the other things it can do. First of all, you can get educated. You can get together once a week or once a month for a potluck dinner and watch a documentary or read books like a book club or a movie club and use those as vehicles to talk about what in the world is going on. I know, and Paul and I are going to talk about it later, one of the things that our circle did for many years is just talk about what in the world is going on in the economy, and we really helped each other get a good picture. We became our own media, in a sense, by sharing our understanding and our news of what we were seeing in the economy. Another thing that a circle can do, a lot of people are very interested in lowering expenses and improving their financial position by lowering expenses. And I've always felt that circles could have a very effective role in bulk purchases. For example, in many cities, their terminal markets, if you got 6 to 12 people together and every week one person took responsibility to get up early, go down to the terminal markets when the trucks come in and buy lots of fresh food in bulk, there's significant things you can do in reducing the price of food. You can also share responsibility for gardening. If you get 12 people together, each with gardens and orchards, there's an awful lot of sharing you can do and tremendous lowering of food costs. So food and anything that lowers your expense area. Another area that's very effective is savings together. I talk in the Soleri audio seminar we did on I guess it was an earlier Soleri report on Soleri circles. It's in your archive about hand or partnerships where 12 people come together. Everybody decides on a certain amount to put in at every meeting. Let's say it's $100. 12 people come together and at every meeting they put $100 in the pot and one person takes it. So think of it as a bank where your deposits are not in the bank. They're out there on the circle. And what's interesting is you'll see many immigrant groups use a partnership or a hand to build the money they need to make a down payment on a car, to make a down payment on a business or a piece of real estate, to make a down payment on a home. And what's interesting is when you do this process together, you start to talk to each other and get advice and help and strategic advice about money. I've known entrepreneurs in New York to do a hand or partnership with other entrepreneurs. And it's really a self-help group for entrepreneurs who get a lot of support and intelligence helping with each other's problems, because entrepreneurship, particularly if you're sole proprietor, can be a very lonely existence, and a hand or partnership will help. Mapping, as I said before, mapping and strategy. What is going on? What do we do about it? If inflation is running at 9.6%, what does that mean, and how can we help each other succeed in this environment? And then people who have a lot more or more sizable assets find it's very useful in terms of doing donations and philanthropy together. So that's another use. But there are many, many different uses. On the investment side, there are really three kinds of tracks that I found people have found useful for this kind of circle. One is simulation. Before, when Paul and I started a circle in 2005, the group that gathered together didn't know each other, and we started with a simulation, and we said we're a family of four, we're homeless, and we have $1 million in cash. So we had to pick a place in the United States, or we had to pick a place in the world. We chose the United States. And then we had to buy the house and invest in building a self-sufficient property, and then the remaining money we proceeded to invest. And in fact, that turned into an audio seminar called Soleri Portfolio Strategy, and you can see the before and after portfolio. You can certainly see the after one that came out of the simulation, or one very similar. So one is simulation. People say to me, well, I can't do an investment club because I have no money. And I say, well, if you're going to have money, you have to learn. The step one is to learn about money, so do a simulation. And now there are all sorts of online tools, Yahoo Finance or others, where you can use software on the web to do a simulation and literally have a portfolio of investments, and you can track them, et cetera. The second to track is to do liquid investment, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Primary focus is securities, so that's equity markets or anything you could do through a brokerage account. And then finally, there's non-liquid investment, which is like private venture or loans or real estate. The crowdfunding regulations are going to be promulgated by the SEC, they say, this year. That's going to trigger a lot of interest in angel kind of investment, and that can be done in a format where everyone sits around and just writes individual checks. They just work together to figure out. They sort of pull their brains. Or another is where you you pool your investment, and in fact, in our if you go to the Solari Circle Library in the archive, you can find our old document for pooling investments through non-liquid investments. And so that's there as well. But tonight we're going to talk about the investment track, doing liquid investment. And so we're going to focus on a Solari Circle for doing liquid investment, which in many respects is very much like a traditional investment club. Now, to do this, there is no better person to join us than for this kind of discussion than Paul Ferguson. Paul was a very successful software entrepreneur turned venture capitalist who runs his family office in Massachusetts. In 2005, Paul and I and eight other founding members created a Solari Circle called the First Ever Solari Circle. Paul was the most experienced of all of us, as one of his relatives founded, and he has twice chaired one of the oldest and largest investment clubs in the country, so he was very seasoned. Paul became our treasurer, and he continued in that role. We met every week by phone. We were 10 people in I think 10 different states all over the country. And we met every week by phone through the end of 2012 when we liquidated the Circle's securities portfolio and dissolved the LLC we had created to invest together. When I posted for this Solari report a copy of I took the operating agreement and guidelines that we created for the Circle, and given the experience that Paul and I and all of us had with it, I marked it up again. And so we're calling it 2.0, and that document is up on the blog post under the subscriber links. And I think if you're interested in doing a Solari Circle investment, liquid investment, I think you will find those documents extremely helpful and very good at sort of guiding your thinking and discussions. One of the reasons I was pretty faithful in attending every week the Solari Circle, which we did on Monday night, one of the reasons was Paul would do a roundup of the markets that was always fascinating and always insightful. So this is a person I've learned a lot from. And so after 7 years of shepherding the investment strategy and transactions for a Solari Circle, Paul is the guy to help us tonight. So, Paul, are you with us?
I am, Catherine, and thank you very much for your kind words and for the invitation to be here.
Well, and I didn't mention, but I should mention, once again, I got a fascinating update from you today because I believe yesterday, Wednesday, you were in New York at the New York Hilton listening to Jim Sinclair's presentation to one and all about the future of the gold markets.
I was, and it was fascinating. There were probably, I don't know, 800 to 1,000 people that gathered in New York to hear Jim, and he gave basically a question and answer session that went for 3 hours, spent a fair amount of time talking about Cyprus, and like you, he considers it to be a very significant series of events that's underway there. And certainly recognizes the geopolitical significance of what's going on. As far as where the gold market's going, he thinks the bottom is in on gold here, particularly because of what's just happened in the Eurozone. And he thinks the mining stocks represent a great bargain. So despite the fact that it's been a tough slog for a couple of years for investors in that sector, he's fairly optimistic right now.
Well, it was funny because right before Cyprus happened, my experience is you had a lot of precious metals investors saying, literally saying, you know, gold's not going anywhere. We want to sell gold. And then Cyprus happens, and they go, oh, I remember why I wanted to sell gold. Because
exactly.
What you realize is, you know, the bank deposits and the fixed income market literally is standing on a world of government guarantees. And if the EU will pull their deposit insurance that sort of quickly and monkey with it, what does it mean about everything else? So, it, you know, it was one of those moments when everybody said, oh, yes, that's why we bought gold. Anyway,
No, I'm sorry. I just wanted to touch on that one point because I think it's important. You were talking about the FDIC earlier and deposit insurance here, and Sinclair made the very important point that the FDIC is fine if one or two banks fail, but there's no systemic insurance because the amount of coverage that they can provide is only a tiny, tiny fraction of the assets that are in the U.S. banking system. So he said, while we enjoy this false sense of security that the FDIC gives us, in a true crisis, it really wouldn't be any protection at all, which is why it's so critical for people to take action to protect themselves.
Right.
Okay.
Now, I've always believed, basically having worked in Washington, I've always believed that the Fed would stand completely behind the FDIC. But here's the reality. If you run the whole economy so that it is fundamentally unsound, at some point no guarantee can be worth anything. Because there's not, you know, if the pie is shrinking, you can't guarantee your way out of that problem. You have to grow the pie.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so in the long run, I'm absolutely with him. I keep hearing the words in the back of my mind. I had a pastor in Washington who used to scream out on Sunday, God does not bless a mess.
Oh, that's true.
So we need an economy that's not a mess. So we're very glad you came tonight to help us do that. So I wanted to start out because, you know, we divided our forms of operating agreement between liquid and illiquid or non-liquid investments. So maybe if we could just start off and describe to the listeners what we mean by liquid investment.
Okay. Well, when I think of liquid investments, it's basically all those items that you can – that can be readily bought and sold, and for this case, through an online brokerage. So those would be stocks of individual companies, bonds, mutual funds, or ETFs, items like that.
Okay, so what we had for the first ever Solaris Circle was we had we essentially used a brokerage account. You can do other things that aren't securities, but obviously there's so much software and sort of easy accounting for doing securities between the brokerage firms and the different online providers that
mm-hmm.
is pretty, I would say liquid, you know, liquid in investment in this context is much easier if you just stick to a brokerage account.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
Okay, so why do this? Why would you go to the bother of getting together and doing an investment club like this? Now, you've done this three times, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Yeah, I've done it a few times, and it's been a different experience each time, and I always learn very, very useful things in the process. But basically, the reason why I think it's important to do this is you have to put your money somewhere. I mean, even staying in cash in a bank is a decision, and as an allocation, and given what's just happened in Europe, it's another reminder that it may not be a no-brainer. In fact, it may require some brain. So you can't, you know, being passive really isn't the same kind of an option that it was in different times. So you have to do something. This market is incredibly difficult. You listen to the most seasoned professionals, and they'll tell you it's the most challenging environment they've ever operated in. You've got distortions in the market from Fed policy. They're in there buying $85 billion worth of assets a month. You've got high-frequency traders that are now well over 50% of the market volume. So there's just things going on out there that haven't existed in earlier markets or are now much, a much greater factor that make it even more difficult than it is usually. So I find that if you can bring a group of people together to take it on, then you have the benefit of everyone's different perspectives and skills and backgrounds, and it's a little bit less formidable and daunting when you can pool your energies and your brain power and your resources and kind of tackle it as a group.
That was my inspiration in 2005. I that we'd had several unusual events in the market, and I just said, you know, I don't want to be alone. I don't want to do this alone. It's too hard.
Absolutely.
And, and I didn't know enough. I couldn't get enough people in Hickory Valley interested in doing it with me. And, in fact, one of the inspirations had been one of my neighbors came up to me and said, you know, we're not going to be able to depend on Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
So we need another plan. So would you start an investment club? Because we need to deal with this, and I would like to get together. And so I know you know a lot about money. Would you start an investment club? So it was one of my neighbor's ideas. And I made an effort to kind of get people together, and I couldn't do it. There was, you know, for a variety of reasons, it just didn't come together. And so that's when I reached out and said to people, let's do it by telephone. And if I can't find folks in my neighborhood, I'll find them remotely. And but my real inspiration was I didn't think I could be intelligent enough alone, and I thought a group of people could be a lot more intelligent than just one person alone.
Absolutely. And the fact that we were geographically distributed did give us the opportunity to learn what was happening on the ground, you know, all across the country on a weekly basis, to get a real, you know, visceral feel for what was happening out there from people that are living in those areas. So I found it to be, there are challenges when you're geographically distributed, but I think I've done it both ways, you know, done it with a local club and then with our circle that was distributed, and there are certainly benefits to having a broader perspective that comes with geographical distribution as well.
Well, I've seen a couple other – one of the reasons I sometimes encourage people to do a Solaria Circle focused on this kind of investment is that what I find is that folks who traditionally have not been interested in finance, you know, they have one source of information about the world. So let's say they read the local paper, and then for
mm-hmm.
their investments, they have another source of information. So they'll read, you know, Yahoo Finance or Bloomberg. And they have two separate worlds, and they think of these worlds as totally separate. And they don't
Yep.
connect the world that they walk around in and see, or the world of politics or, you know, governance. In their minds, it has absolutely no connection with investment. They don't have an integrated view of the world. They don't have an integrated map. And one of the things I say to them is, look, if you're going to govern the management of your own assets, which everybody ultimately has to do,
mm-hmm.
You know, you need to start to integrate these worlds. And to me, the fastest way to integrate them is to just start doing investments. You know, start going into that world of investment and start connecting the dots between your day-to-day world and what you know or what you want to learn about and what's going on in that world. Because, you know, you
Yep.
and I both know when we watch the prices swing around and we see how the money's moving, to
Yep.
me, that's part of reality, whereas you'll read the paper and they'll say something very, very different than what's, you know, so if the long treasury bond market is down, you know, 8% for the last 6 months, but the, you know, the newspapers are saying everything's wonderful, you see,
mm-hmm.
you know, you see an integrated reality if you're watching the money. Anyway, So part of it is I just think people get a much better map of their world if they, you know, if they start to integrate into this. And the other thing, interestingly enough, our inspiration for doing this, Solaria Report, we have a wonderful family who are subscribers, and the parents said, you know, we want our kids to learn how to one day assume responsibility for the family assets. So we want to do a Solaria Circle so that we can start to learn as a family how to build wealth together, and we can make sure that the next generation coming up knows how to assume responsibility for these assets. So to me, it's a great way for families If you go back and listen to the Solari report on family wealth with Jay Hughes, which is one of my favorites, he talks about getting the family together once a month for dinner, you know, to talk strategically about how do we help each other succeed. And, and you know, and part of that is managing their assets together. So so one of the things, one big question is, if you do this, do you want to do it in your family? Do you want to do it with friends? Do you want to do it in colleagues? Who do you want to do it with? And my experience is there's a huge range of possibilities, but the one thing I would say is you always want to do it with people you can trust.
Absolutely. You want to do it with people you can trust. I mean, we do have some taboos in our culture about talking about money. It's very, you know, it's considered private and intimate. But the circle does give you a structure and a format where you can deal with some of these difficult and challenging issues in a setting that's energizing and educational for everybody. So it absolutely makes sense. And as you were talking about, it's like I need to start doing something like this with my family. My daughters are now 18 and 19, and my older daughter asked me when she was on Christmas break about investing. She said she wanted to start learning about it. So I think now.
Oh, how wonderful!
Yeah. So thanks for planting that seed. I've got to get started on that myself. Another circle. Here we go.
Here you go. Well,
it's great.
One of the things we didn't do when we brought together, and I should mention our circle was, the name was First Ever Solari Circle.
Yeah.
But when we started, we called it FESC, First Ever Solari Circle. When we started First Ever Solari Circle, we didn't do a time budget. And the one thing, I think the most important thing when you design out a circle is for each person to make a clear decision about how much time they're willing to contribute.
Mm-hmm.
And then you organize your activities within that time budget. And so if everybody can only give 2 hours a month, then you have an hour to meet and you have an hour to do research, and whatever you do is going to have to, you know, fit within that budget.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, it's important to have a balance of contribution. So everybody needs to contribute, but you need to operate, you know, you need to design a scope within the time that you're willing to commit, and you need to organize it in a way which saves time. So for me, you know, the time I spent on the circle helped me not struggle alone with trying to figure out what was going on. So in that sense, it saved me time. And I think you really want to be very, very sensitive to people's time. And that's another reason to keep it small. It's the larger you get, the harder it is to get a group of people who are very committed to respecting each other's time.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, you want to keep it, you want to keep it fun, right? That's important to remember when you're going through it. It should be fun, and it's possible to keep it fun. But so as far as the but on the other hand, in order for it to work well, there is a certain amount of administration that needs to be done. So
right.
You got to have a right. You got to strike the right balance between making sure that, you know, the business that needs to get taken care of gets taken care of, that everybody's contributing, but that it's not so much that it becomes a burden or people start to feel like this is work. You know, but if people don't put any energy into it, then nobody's going to get much out of it either. So absolutely,
right.
Knowing, you know, being realistic about what people are willing to do, what each participant is willing to do is important up front to make sure everybody understands that. Absolutely.
How much have you found, in your experience, Paul, how much should someone be willing to invest in a circle?
Well, I gave it some thought when you sent your notes before the call, and I think it's one of those situations where you need it to be enough so that people will take it seriously and pay attention and feel like it's worthy of their time and effort to remain and, you know, to stay involved and to stay active. But it shouldn't be so much that it becomes, you know, either a significant portion of their assets or net worth, or it, you know, where the management of those funds becomes a real concern for them. So it's that there's a happy medium in there somewhere, I think, and everyone's got to know what their own comfort level is. And then the other thing is you don't want it to be too skewed towards any one member. You know, it should be fairly, it doesn't have to be exactly even in terms of partnership ownership, but more or less a balance so one person doesn't feel like their vote should count, you know, more than everyone else.
Right. Well, what I've gotten from, you know, from the younger subscribers and readers, one of the, you know, they said, well, we don't have a lot of money. And what I've said is, well, first of all, start with a simulation. So, you know, the key to making money is not necessarily having money. The key to making money is knowing how to make money. And
right.
Getting good at this through simulation doesn't cost, you know, it takes your time but not your money. And you can get pretty good just through simulation. But even, you know, it will be more real if you do real money. So why not start with a small amount and
yep.
each year put in more like a savings club and let it grow? And,
well, you develop the mechanisms, you develop the practices and the, you know, the thinking. I mean, you're going to hone all of that as you're going along. So that absolutely makes sense to me.
Right. And then even if you do have more assets, you know, if this is new and you want to, you don't want to put a lot in because you want to get to know each other, you build trust, you start to build confidence about investing as a group, and then you, you know, each year you can put in more. So it can grow as the you know, as the process develops.
Mm-hmm. Start
so
the shallow end.
One of the critical things is to understand roles and responsibilities. Now, as I said, we put the operating agreement, the form of an operating and agreement and guidelines, which is a markup of what Paul and I use for First Ever Solaria Circle, and it's up in the subscriber links on the blog post. But let's just, and if you read through it, I think you'll get a sense of roles and responsibilities because we envision a group there, some of which you may want to use or obviously you configure it the way you want, but we thought that would be helpful. But maybe if we could just touch on the different roles and responsibilities and go through those, Paul.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, generally the circle is like a traditional investment club in terms of the structure, and you want a chairperson, a treasurer, and a secretary. At least those are your club officers. The chairman will, you know, put together the agenda and schedule the meetings and so forth. The secretary generally is responsible for, you know, sending out minutes or taking minutes, handling some of the administrative functions. And then the treasurer typically would take care of dealing with the brokerage, managing the portfolio in terms of keeping track of it in whatever accounting software you're using. We used the online iClub software. So those are the and then other clubs might have an information officer or, you know, depending on how large the group gets, you might have an assistant chairman. So, you know, you kind of have to gauge your what's appropriate based on the size of the circle. And in some cases, if your circle's small, then there's going to be somebody probably wearing multiple hats. So in some situations, I functioned as, you know, all three. I do not recommend that. That is not
right.
But yeah, in a smaller circle, you might have to be both secretary and treasurer, for example.
Right. And one possibility is to rotate those functions.
Absolutely.
So we never rotated the functions in Solaria Circle, but I think rotating those functions is a very good idea. And if you can envision that from the beginning, it's healthy because then you get more of a balance.
Yeah, and it's good for everybody to know, you know, what's involved in and to give them a sense of ownership. Otherwise, you know, it's very easy. It's easy to kind of kick back and let other people do most of the heavy lifting, but then you're not going to get much out of it that way. So
right.
I think, you know, demanding participation from all the members is something that is definitely vital to keeping the organization vibrant and useful for everyone.
Well, one of the things I suggested, and I added to these the operating agreement guidelines was setting, the group setting sort of mandatory standards for participation and contribution from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And because I think you keep a much better tempo to the group if you have, if you pretty much restrict it to people who are actively participating and contributing. And if somebody
mm-hmm.
can't, you need to make it easy for them to withdraw and, you know, maybe they can come back. But you really need to keep that tempo, because if you don't have a tight consistency there, then you're gonna have a few people doing everything, and it's gonna get out of balance. So to me, setting those standards going in is gonna be important. Another
mm-hmm.
thing we had under the roles and responsibilities was envisioning people who were focused on different kinds of investment research. But I do think everybody's gonna have to commit to doing some kind of investment research, and that's why it's very important that when you decide on what your investment focus is going to be, it's going to be things you want to learn about and are interesting in, because to keep that pace of learning over time, you want to keep moving through the markets and focusing on those areas of investment, you know, that really speak to your desire to learn and participate. I know we had a particular focus and strategy in the first ever Solari Circle, and as the market shifted, that was one of the questions, was how do we shift our investment strategy? So how does the group grapple with what do we want our focus to be, and how do we develop an investment strategy?
Well, I think for us, I mean, one of the things that's different and special and unique, I would say, about the Solari Circle is that your participants are all coming into it, not with maybe the exact same mindset, but with a very similar outlook on the world and set of values. And so that gives you a little bit of a leg up, and I think in terms of having an outlook, you know, the worldview and the market and what you do with your investments is all tied together, as you were talking about before. So when you have kind of a shared worldview, that lends itself to having a cohesive focus and strategy. So for in our case, given what's going on in the world and the market and with the dollar and everything else, we decided that you know, defense was very critical in this environment, and staying in precious metals for the most part was probably the most prudent investment allocation decision we could make. And in retrospect, it turned out to be absolutely the right decision. And
right.
But I think that coming to that, I mean, I thought as I was preparing for this discussion tonight, I was thinking about how could I have done that in one of my other investment clubs, and there's just no way. I mean, I would have gotten shot down as soon as the word gold came out of my mouth. So,
right.
Yeah, we were having that very different.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's having a common place that you're coming from to work on these issues, I think, really does give you a leg up.
Yeah. It was, I will say this, Mr. Ferguson beat the index every year. I believe, was it every, maybe not 2012, we might not have beat the index 2012, but we certainly did every other year. I wanted to talk a little bit about this notion of total economic return, because two of the things that make a Solari Circle unique is, one is generally we try to keep it smaller, more intimate, and more consensus focused, and that's number one. But number two, generally we're interested in finding things to invest in which are useful to this world, so avoiding things which are destructive. And what I find is that every human being has a different definition of what that is, and it's an art, not a science. So
yep.
One of the things I added to the operating agreement and guidelines was, before you get going, creating a common vision of what that is. You know, what's useful, what's not useful. And I think, you know, most people using good sense can do a pretty good job of that.
Mm-hmm.
I know one of the ways I do it is I just say, look, I'm going to avoid all large caps because I'm trying to decentralize. And generally because smaller companies which get bought up generally have a better return. They have a higher volatility but a better return over time. Avoiding this, you know, the large caps is one of the ways I do it. I keep it pretty simple. But I think sitting down and saying, okay, you know, we want to invest in things that make the world better. What's our definition of that? What are we going to avoid?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I have a very strict rule with anybody who deals with me. Monsanto is no. No. No.
There's some easy. Yes.
But I know we didn't come up with those guidelines to begin with, and I remember you and I sitting through some pretty uncomfortable conversations because we tried to figure out how to do food and agricultural stocks, which I would point out have done gangbusters over the last 3 years.
Right.
And of course, you know, we had a lot of people who, you know, who would have preferred to do local investment as opposed to securities investment, and so it got very complicated. Anyway, so I would say do, you know, don't make that up as you go. Try and come up with some simple guidelines to begin with. Picking a brokerage firm, how does the circle go about picking a brokerage firm?
Well, I mean, really, practically speaking, your choices are fairly limited. You know, I mean, you want to keep your transaction costs low, especially if you're dealing with a relatively small amount of money. You want it to be a smaller percentage of your funds as possible. So that means you're going to be going with a discount broker. So that's, you know, someone that provides online discount brokerage. Which ones are better than the others, I really, you know, have a hard time with that. But because, you know, there's only so much we can know as retail investors about what's going on in the back office. But, you know, we ended up with Scottrade. I find if you find a broker that treats you well, that you have, preferably has a local office that you can actually go and speak to somebody, that's helpful. So there are some brokerages like, I know Fidelity or, I don't know, Scottrade, others have local branches that you can actually visit. So, and then use people's experience, draw on the experiences that all your members have, you know, who's had good or bad experiences with different brokers, and use that as well.
One of the things, I'm sure, if you do get a firm that has an office locally, you know, one thing I've found is that they will always welcome your club to come in and get a little briefing and lecture and tour. You know, and a little introduction to how to use the software, et cetera. So, you know, being a club, you know, you've got purchasing circle power.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so you can get a little attention. Yeah. One question while we're at it. I just got a question. I already have a paid financial advisor, so would an investment circle still benefit me? So you take this one, but I'll take it too.
Okay, well, I would say yes, because, look, a paid financial advisor is going to give you probably very sound mainstream advice. But, you know, depending on who that advisor is, they may have certain predispositions about things like alternative investments or you know, assets like gold or whatever that traditionally are not promoted by mainstream advisors because they get there's a number of reasons. You know, it's the assets that aren't under their management, so they don't get a fee. It kind of belies a lack of confidence in the financial system, which, you know, is contrary to the business they're trying to promote. So I would say, you know, but if it's somebody like yourself, for example, then maybe there would be less utility. I just find that having a number of people with different perspectives, different skill sets, different backgrounds, you get a better picture. You have more data points, and if they're the right people, then it's good information that you're getting. So I can't see how, I don't know, I have a hard time seeing how you wouldn't benefit.
Well, I think here's what I feel, because I think some people would benefit, some not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have friends, family, clients who say, you know, I love what I do, and I just don't want to spend any time on this. So I want somebody else to do it for me, and I'm happy to govern it, and I want to know enough so that I know how to govern it and oversee other people managing it, but I just don't want to manage it. I don't, you know, that's not fun for me. Now, in fact, there are ways of doing a circle that say, okay, well, what do you, let's say you're fascinated by the entertainment world, so you start a circle and you just do entertainment stocks.
Mm-hmm.
Or you do an angel circle and you do crowdfunding for artists, you know, or something like that, or when the SEC promulgates the crowdfunding rules, so you focus it that way. So it might be interesting for you as something else, but in that sense, no, it wouldn't make sense for you to do a circle because you have other things you want to do with your time.
Covered raising chickens and mobile chicken coops. I mean, we covered a lot of great territory. It wasn't
we had mobile slaughterhouses. We did everything. You know, to me, one of the reasons to do a circle is to understand your world. And I'm amazed because you have so many wonderful people, you know, in Europe, in America, in Asia. They understand their living ecosystem, but they don't understand the financial ecosystem, and they can't integrate them. So part of the reason I encourage some people to do it is, look, this is just a way to learn about how your world works and get smart and be able to kind of see what's going on in a way that protects yourself. Or, you know, to really, let's say you really want to govern your money, particularly if you have an awful lot of money, I think that learning how to manage a small piece of it by yourself can really make you much more astute at governing it and dealing with money managers. So I'm not saying, you know, use this to manage all your money. I would take a tiny piece and, you know, and I would start out very small and build up. We started with a simulation and then did tiny dollars. So, you know, I know many people who do this, you know, people who have very significant assets, they have a tiny amount that they do in an investment club kind of context, and they use that information as portfolio mapping and strategy for their other assets, which they do
separately. Absolutely.
And members of our club were absolutely doing that.
Oh, sure. It makes sense.
Yeah, so
I mean,
they would take what they learned, and then they would go off and do things in their own money that were very private, no one knew.
Yep.
So we were kind of a tiny experimental pot where they would take what they got and use it on their money, you know, back when. So I think for some people, if you have professional people managing your money, I think for some people taking a small piece and doing a circle makes tremendous sense. For others, it's, you know, it's not where they're going to get their kicks. And I keep coming back again. This is, you should be doing this with people you enjoy, and it should be a process you enjoy, and you should be learning about things you want to learn about. So,
yep.
You know, it's got to work that way. Well, let's just talk a little bit about, let me just say, rather than go through the nuts and bolts of the transactions and accounting and taxes, what I would do is encourage everyone to go through, if you're interested, the form of the operating agreement and guidelines, which, again, are posted at the blog. And we've also, in the introduction to the forums, we've also posted some of the best books on starting an investment club that are more traditional in orientation than the circle. But a lot of the material is very, very useful to starting a circle as well. Okay, so longevity, Paul. How do you keep the circle going after, you know, people run out of ideas?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't know that we ever ran out of ideas, although I guess there were some times where it was harder to come up with things than others. But, you know, I think that there's a couple of different ways to do that. If you're in a period where there's not much happening, or you're not getting as much value out of the club as you were, or the circle, then you can perhaps meet less frequently. If you're meeting every week, then you could go to a biweekly or maybe once a month thing. But I think that it's an organic entity, and so if it's not at a place where it's continuing to provide value for everybody, then then maybe that's a sign that it's time to wrap it up and move on to the next thing. So I don't know.
One of the reasons I wanted to pull out of the first ever Solari Circle was, you know, now I'm working on a team on money management, so I'm spending several hours a day in a team context working on, you know, investment strategy, monitoring, et cetera. And then also I'm talking with you every week about the same. And so it was another hour to do that. And given the time we had at night, given my travel schedule, it was very hard to make it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was more a change in circumstance, I think, for some of us. But I would say this, because it was our producer who asked me that question originally. And one of the things I said is, you know, investment, you know, whether it's liquid or illiquid, involves everything on the whole planet. It involves all places, all different kinds of activities, from healthcare to sports to entertainment to food to transportation to grocery stores and food stores and fashion. Our investment club has been plowing me through looking at high fashion companies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there I am in the investment committee saying, I've never gotten Coach. I just never got that handbag thing. Or it was really funny because I'm one of those people, you know me, Paul, I have to try it. I cannot invest in it if I haven't tried it. So we were looking at this company that sells these high cost creams. Well, sure enough,
okay,
I got on Amazon $150 for like a tiny jar of cream. I couldn't believe it. I bought it.
Oh my God.
My Quaker ancestors were fainting, and it was horrible. I didn't like it at all. But, you know, I have
God.
To, you know me, I have to experience it personally. I can't, you know, so anyway, but it involves all activities in the world and all, you know, all places, all countries. And so I can't imagine ever getting bored by investment because it's everything. It's the whole, you know, pick up a world almanac. It involves all of it. And the politics of, you know, the financial system, of course, is highly complicated, and the geopolitics are wild. And so you're getting, you know, you're going in and you're dealing with a real deal. The thing to me which is the most inspiring is that
mm-hmm.
every day I'm looking at teams of people who are creating enterprises that do fantastically useful things.
Yep.
You know, they just... You know, you have entrepreneurs, and you never see this or get this when you hear the news or you listen to the news. But all around the world, there are teams of people coming together and starting companies to solve the real problems before us. And it is the most inspiring thing to see and hear and read. So you read about the companies that are making the fabrication, you know, equipment or making the 3D printers, or they're coming together to come up with new desalination techniques for water or ways of purifying water or cleaning water, or, you know, it goes on and on and on. And they're these quirky little businesses you never thought of. And to me, it's the most positive, hopeful flow of information I've ever dealt with. And I can never imagine getting tired of it. Now, maybe that's why I'm in the investment business. but the idea of getting bored with it,
yeah,
I can't imagine it. Now, I think
no.
One thing I would say, one of the things that I did not do a good job when we started our circle, we had some people who were very interested in local investment and some people who were very interested in securities investment. And, in fact,
right.
If you're interested in local investment, you ought to do an angel format or you ought to pool for non-liquid investment. You know,
right.
If you're going to do securities investment, you need people who are really interested to do that. And so
we couldn't,
you need to,
yeah, doing local investment with a geographically dispersed group was not a combination that could work. I think it's
right.
Got to be a little, no, it just
right.
won't, because you have
yeah.
to have that comfort of being able to, you know, to see and talk to the people that you're doing business with.
Yeah, so we could never, and it was funny because a couple of times I went to the people who were committed to local investment and said, look, you know, you need to withdraw because we need this to be focused. We need a tempo. We need a beat. And they didn't want to withdraw because we all found it so interesting to talk about what was going on every week. And, of course, you know, we kept outperforming the index. But we could never kind of sort out that local versus, you know, global differentiation and so if you want to do something on local, that's great, but you need to do it with people in your area. You can't do local remote. It's not going to work that way. So the one other thing I wanted to mention, at the blog, Paul, I put up a link to my iClub, and maybe you could just describe my iClub, because we use them, and I found that to be a marvelous support mechanism for a Solaria Circle.
Mm-hmm. My iClub is a web-based accounting tool that is really essential if you're doing an investment club or Solaria Circle where you get a brokerage account and start putting money to work, because it gives you all of the tools that you will need to track ownership, to generate reports, to do taxes, to monitor the portfolio. It's all in one package, and it's very easy to administer. The online help is good, and I just cannot imagine trying to run a circle without a tool like that. And there's only one other that's out there called Vivio. I've never used it. In all the investment clubs I've used, we've always used the iClub, which is it started out as a desktop tool, a PC software that was put out by the National Association of Investment Clubs, the NAIC, and the My iClub is online version of that software.
Yeah, it's a great. Does it cost anything, or is it open source?
No, there is an annual subscription, but there's no limit on the number of members in your club. So the club or the circle has to pay a yearly subscription, and then...
But it was pretty modest, as I remember.
Yeah, it's less than $100. It's like $60 or something like that.
Right, and if you look at what it would be like to do that without it, you know, it's
very...
Imagine.
No, yeah. I can't imagine. You wouldn't want to do that.
No, you certainly wouldn't want to be the treasurer and do that. So in summary, Paul, just in closing, please let us know anything else you'd like to add. And what I'd love to hear is, you know, in all your experiences of doing investment clubs, what did you most enjoy? What did you most enjoy doing in First Ever Solaria Circle? What did you get out of it? How did it benefit you?
Well, I just think it was really important, in particularly in these times that we're in right now, to have a sounding board, to have a group, you know, an intimate group of like-minded individuals to kind of try to navigate through this madness that we're in. And even if we were in better times, I think it's useful to leverage the strengths of others and to help you see the world in a broader perspective. So for me, you know, it's all about having a group of people that I really respect and like and trust and value their perspectives, and having that available to me on a regular basis was just invaluable.
Brett, I would say that we had a marvelous group of people in the First Ever Solaria Circle, and the conversation was always very enriching and uplifting, and people would bring ideas or news that, you know, I would never thought of. I always left with my mind expanded. And one of my favorite things is, the news would say something about something going on in Oregon, and our Oregon member would say, oh, no, here's the real deal on that. You know, and somebody from Ohio would say, oh, no, here's the real deal on that. And here's what's really going. You know, we had one person who was from Louisiana originally, and all his relatives kept us up to date on what was going on at the Gulf oil spill. And, you know, it just kept everything grounded, because you had people in 10 different, you know, we had East Coast, West Coast, middle of the country, and you had all
Hawaii.
These different perspectives, Hawaii. And, you know, we just kept, everybody just kept bringing us back to ground. And it was very enriching, and I'm very glad we did it. But it would never have worked if we hadn't had the world's best treasurer. So my favorite thing about the First Ever Solaria Circle, as I said when I introduced you, was Paul Ferguson and his roundup on the markets once a week. I couldn't be without it.
Well, thank you, Catherine.
So Paul, thank you very much for joining us on the Solari Report, and thank you for everything you've done for this network. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Okay, my great pleasure. Thank you, Catherine, for everything that you've done for us also.
Well, it's a pleasure. So any chance you got a chance to watch the documentary?
Oh, that was great. I loved it.
Good. Yeah, let me just briefly describe it. So stay on and share with us on the documentary. And let's go to the movies. I chose Something Ventured, which is a recent documentary that tells the story of the venture capitalists who financed the creation of a whole series of Silicon Valley companies. So that's south of San Francisco, Intel, Apple, Cisco, Atari, Genentech, PowerPoint, and Tandem. And it's a very interesting story of the non-liquid side of the house. This is investment, private venture investment, before people go to the public markets and turn the securities into liquid so they can be traded. And it shows you, it gives you a wonderful feeling for how wonderful things are when it works. They leave out how depressing it can be on the other, you know, for everyone that works, the 30 that don't. And
yeah.
Interestingly enough, in venture capital, I can hear Paul in the background, he knows that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it takes a remarkable person, and of course you're the venture capitalist here, Paul. It takes a remarkable person to, you know, keep using their creativity and imagination through the 30 that don't work for the one that works. And interestingly enough, in venture capital, you know, on a portfolio of 30 with one that works, the one that works makes enough to cover all your costs on the 30 that don't. And one of the reasons I wanted you to see this is not only does it put you in the let's make a deal mood, but if the possibilities when the crowdfunding regulations are promulgated this year by the SEC, and those are the provisions under the Jobs Act that will let crowdfunding be applied for equity deals sort of through the Internet. I think it gives you a sense, if you can imagine that milieu in a much smaller mode, a sort of a crowdfunding mode, it sort of sets the tone for what could happen with crowdfunding. So tell us what you thought of the documentary, Paul.
Well, I thought it was fascinating. I don't know where to start, but just the way these guys could start with an idea and create something from nothing, it takes a real kind of suspension of disbelief. All the things that can go wrong along the way, I mean, it's really, you have to be a little bit crazy to start a business, I think, or to believe and invest in somebody that's crazy enough to start a business. But without it,
Yeah. We
wouldn't have, you know, the genius and innovation that we all take for granted around us. So there is some bravery that's involved, I think, and a little bit of madness.
Yep. And, you know, frankly, it's always been one of America's great strengths. We have more entrepreneurial and venture capital madness than any other country on the planet, or we have had. China is beginning to surpass us in that sense, but there's still plenty of it here. And
absolutely.
But I think that documentary gets you in the mood for it. Do you know what I mean? And it really
it's still there. It's still out there. I see it every day, and I think you're right. We just have to kind of focus on those things and nurture them.
Right. Right, because it's, you know, to me, the way to get back to an economy that works is to be part of enterprises and activities that help it work.
Mm-hmm.
So stop putting our money and our time in the enterprises that drain the economy and start putting our time in bank deposits and investments in the enterprises that are building the economy. To me, it's always been very simple.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just pull away from the negative and support the positive. And frankly, if everybody did that, it would make an enormous difference. And that's why I love that Kickstarter example, because in 3 years, Kickstarter has gone from, you know, a website in, you know, in the boroughs of New York to being almost double the size of the National Endowment of the Arts.
Really? That's amazing.
That's amazing. So I'm ready. Let's make a deal. Okay, Mr. Ferguson, thank you again.
Thank you very much, Catherine. Good night.
Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, in closing, coming up next week, John Rappaport. It's John Rappaport Week at the Salieri Report. I'm going to join him for the conversation. We're going to be doing it live. We're going to be talking about all of his different work on imagination, and it's called Exit from the Matrix. And this is my favorite part of John's work, and we're going to be exploring it next week, March 28th. And then April 4th, the first quarter wrap-up. That's when I take a look at what's happened over the first quarter, compare it to what I said in the annual wrap-up, and sort of point at the dot on the map and say, we are here. Then April 11th is our Coming Clean. We're going to be doing Precious Metals with Franklin Sanders and Larry Pratt, the very eloquent head of Gun Owners of America, is going to be joining us, and we'll learn a lot more about what's going on in the debate at the federal level on gun controls and at the state level as well. And then big one on April 18th, Chuck Gibson and I are going to be doing the equity markets overview and talk about what's going to happen in the bond market, and if the bond market starts to turn, where is that money going to go? Will it go into the equity markets? Very big questions that many money managers are thinking about right now. So until next week with John Rappaport, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. And if you want to start one using liquid investment, just check out the forms of the operating agreements and guidelines for a Salieri Circle that does investment on the blog links for this Salieri Report. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.